2070. Your thoughts on the rule of Narendra Modi and what it means, for example, not to commit when it comes to use of energy to ending coal?
Well, Amy, can you hear me better now?
Yes, a little better.
Yes. Well, look, let's just admit straight away that these net zero commitments are a kind of farce in any case. I mean, people are just pulling these numbers out of their heads. And a large part of this is simply because around the world today, leaders have become experts at greenwashing. They talk this language of greenwashing. And around the world, you know, even the most benign sounding people like Justin Trudeau, I mean, you know, they talk this greenwashing rhetoric, but at the same time, they're constantly licensing more and more fossil fuel exploration. And that is exactly what Narendra Modi is doing as well. You know, I mean, he's talking a sort of greenwashing talk. At the same time, they've licensed 55 new coal plants, you know, which are going to come up in India's forests. These coal mines are going to wreck the lives of hundreds of thousands of forest-dwelling Adivasis or indigenous peoples, perhaps millions of them. Fortunately, this year, at least some Adivasis from India were able to be present at COP26. They were able to actually articulate their positions and their points of view. But essentially what this Narendra Modi's government has done, and it's not just his government, even the Congress governments before that were doing the same thing, was they were opening all of India up to the most rapacious kinds of extractive industries. It's a terrible process to witness.
Amitabh Ghosh, in your book, you also emphasize what you call radical empathy. Could you explain what that means and how that potentially could have an emancipatory effect with respect to climate crisis?
Well, as we were saying earlier, in going back to the Enlightenment, the 17th century, and so on, we get this this mechanistic vision of the Earth as something that's dead, as something that really exists only to provide people, you know, powerful human beings with resources. And I think at bottom, we just have to move away from that, move away completely to a different way of envisioning the Earth. You know, I'm a writer, and I think stories play a very fundamental part in this. But I do think this can actually have an important political impact. I mean, if you look at the people who've resisted fossil fuel industries most effectively in America, they're indigenous peoples. I mean, I know that you and Amy have been covering the No DAPL movement for a very long time. And as you know, the ideas about the sacredness of the earth were very important to that movement. You know, it's not necessarily something that you or the press always emphasizes, but in fact, the longevity of that movement, the resilience of that movement, really depends on Native American ideas of the sacredness of the earth, of the vitality of the earth. And, you know, movements like that are now appearing all around the world. In fact, you could even say that India spearheaded some of these movements. We had a movement called the Chipko movement, when women hugged trees to prevent their being cut down. But, you know, one of the sort of really really positive things that I see in the world today is that even high courts and Supreme Courts are beginning to recognize these ideas. I mean, in New Zealand recently, there was a judgment from I think it was the Supreme Court, that recognized the personhood of a river. So I think these ideas are becoming more and more widespread, and I think they could lead to a sort of change of heart across the earth.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Amitabh Ghosh, award-winning Indian novelist and writer. His new book is just out. It's called The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. And that does it for our show. His previous book, The Great Derangement. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll speak to climate scientist Kevin Anderson and the writer George Monbiot. Democracy Now! Currently has job openings. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yow.
You know what? Grant and I and the rest of the Away With Words team have been sending out this podcast for 14 years now, and we still have so much more to talk about. We're just getting started. Your questions and stories are what keep this show going. We could never do it without you. We learned so much from you, and we're so grateful. We also depend on your financial support. Go to waywardradio.org/donate and help out the nonprofit that produces this show. Here's to lots more learning and laughter.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Not that long ago, we were talking about indefinite hyperbolic numerals. You remember that conversation, Grant?
Right. 40, 11, zillions, jillions, and all those other approximate numbers.
Right, those indefinite approximate numbers. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was visiting family in the mountains of North Carolina, and I heard another one that I really love and am going to adopt, which is Humpty 12.
Humpty 12. Maybe about a dozen, but maybe not a dozen, a little more, a little less.
A whole, yeah. I went on vacation and I came back and there were Humpty 12 pieces of junk mail.
Sounds like a cousin of umpteen.
Yes, I think it probably is, but it just, I don't know, it's just something delicious to roll around on your tongue. And you know what? I was also looking around a little bit more, and you may be familiar with this one. You can also use the term telephone number or telephone numbers. Apparently, since the 1940s, if you were talking telephone numbers, you were talking about a really big number. So people would talk about that in terms of a large sum of money. You know, that house costs telephone numbers, or it could be applied to your time in prison. You know, he's doing telephone numbers.
I can imagine a time in the history of the world where most people didn't encounter a big number until they got a telephone number or saw one.
Yeah,
well, I
got
to say,
cool,
we have umpty 12 things to talk about on this show. And if you'd like to join us, here's our telephone number, 877-929-9673. You can also email us, words@waywardradio.org. And you can talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hi there. You have a way with words.
Hey, Martha. How are you? My name's Bobby, and I'm from Mount Sterling, Kentucky.
Oh, excellent. Welcome to the show.
Here's my thing. I was born in Toledo, Ohio, and moved away from there when I was like 11. But while I was there, my brother, who is 10 years older than me, would often come in and say, "Hey, guys, what's the lowdown?" And I would be like, "What does that mean, the lowdown?" You know, being a kid, I was like, I didn't understand. So I, later in life, I really never heard it in Kentucky, but often would go back and visit family in Ohio. And again, people would say, "What's the lowdown?" And I never really understood what it meant. I just always assumed it meant what's happening.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds about right. What's the lowdown? So just tell me about the situation.
Well, I can't really give you a situation. It was just like he would come in from being out and just, you know, the family would be all around and he'd come in and say, "Hey, guys, what's the lowdown?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually when people see that, they mean give me the skinny or the scoop or the details or tell me what I don't know.
Well, right? I never really understood the lowdown part. I kind of was like, is he talking about the bottom line?
The bottom line is that's lowdown on the bill.
Mm-hmm. That's a good guess.
That's a good guess.
Well, thanks.
Well, no, it comes from the idea of low, meaning shameful or naughty or bad. You know, when something is low, it's near the ground, it's dirty. And so...
Well, that would be my brother.
Oh, excuse me, what? That would be your brother?
I said, that would definitely be my brother. He's so bad.
Well, originally, and when this first appears in the early 1900s with the idea of information, it was the idea that the information might be secret, or that the secret is shameful or naughty, or that sharing the secret or the information is shameful or naughty.
Kind of makes sense. But I'm curious, Grant, is it more geographical? Because I've really never heard it from people in Kentucky, and I didn't know if there was something more.
It's fairly widespread in the United States.
Mm.
It comes from an older word, an adjective, lowdown, just as in like, you lowdown dirty dog, something you might hear Western. From around the 1860s, which itself meant disreputable or unworthy or shameless or trashy or contemptible.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's got a modern slang derivative too. This is the adverb, the down low. So if somebody says something on the down low, they do it secretly. So they've switched it's not low down, it's down low. Or on the DL, right?
On the DL. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's all related. Well, so this has got all these little tributaries from this one main idea of low meaning contemptible or naughty or shameful.
Well, I really appreciate you clearing that up for me. Thank you so much.
You got the lowdown, Bobby.
That's the scoop. That's the skinny.
I finally got the lowdown.
You did. Take care now.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll give you the lowdown, the scoop, the skinny, the scuttlebutt on whatever your language question is. 1-877-929-9673.
Heard a little story from Mike in Kentucky who says, my 5-year-old granddaughter walked out to me and said, look, Grandpa, I put my shoes on and tied them all by myself. She was very proud. I looked at her shoes and said, well, honey, you did a great job, but I'm afraid you have them on the wrong feet. And she looked down and said, no, Grandpa, those are my feet. Yeah, so a nice little bit of ambiguity there, linguistically speaking.
Oh, what's the funny thing you heard? Let us know on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Jennifer from Tallahassee.
Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jennifer.
Well, I tutor elementary age children, and we love words, and we like to talk about the sounds and meanings of words. And the other day, I was getting into one of my book bags, and I said something about my book bag being chock-a-block full. And this said, what does chock-a-block mean? So I said, I have no idea. Actually, I have a kind of, I think that it means like happily full, but I don't know. So I thought I'd call you all and ask.
Yeah, so it was crammed full. I mean, that's the idea of chock-a-block, right?
Right. It was very full of things. And I said it was chock-a-block full, yes.
It's a delicious term to say, too, isn't it? Chock-a-block.
Isn't it so fun? Actually, that's what we did. We paused and said it together a couple of times afterwards because it is so fun to say.
Chock-a-block.
Jennifer, it's even more fun than that because there's some really interesting history behind the term chock-a-block. You may know the term chock, which is an old word, C-H-O-C-K, chock, which is an old word for a wedge that's used to keep something in place. And on old sailing ships, you would put wooden chocks under a barrel to keep it from moving, you know, when the ship is at sea. Or you might chock an anchor when it's not in use. And we're not sure of the origin of chock, although it may be related to the earlier term chock full. So hold on to that part of it, chock. The block, in this case, comes from the block and tackle system of pulleys on an old ship. It's what helps you do things like raise and lower a heavy sail. And with a block and tackle system, in its simplest form, it involves threading a rope through blocks of wood that contain a pulley. And in that block and tackle system, one block containing a pulley stays still, and you pull on the rope, and the other pulley, which is also in a block, moves up and down as you pull on that rope. So when you're pulling on that rope on a ship, and that moving block containing the pulley gets all the way up to the stationary one, then those blocks are now jammed up against each other. It's like no matter how hard you pull, you can't pull anymore. You've pulled the rope as far as it'll go, and those blocks are said to be chock-a-block. It's as if something like a chock is preventing them from moving. How cool is that?
That is so interesting. So really, it's like a sailor term. It's like it's a mm-hmm. ship.
Mm-hmm.
This is how interesting. I would have never guessed.
Mm-hmm.
So about how old is it? Do you know? Do you know when it was first?
Well, it's been around for hundreds of years, but it was by the early 19th century that we landlubbers started using it to describe something that's really close together, chock-a-block. Sometimes sailors call that situation two-block or block-and-block, but the one that stuck is your beloved word.
That is so much fun. So maybe next time when I'm with my students, I should say it like a pirate, right? Say something like, "Arg, me, chock-a-block fool."
Yes.
You sound like my kind of teacher, Jennifer.
Oh, we do. We have such a good time. We learn a lot, but we really do make learning. We have a really good time.
You sound like a fun teacher. I want to go back to school.
Come on, Grant. We can talk about words.
Jennifer, thank you so much for calling us and brightening our day. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was really a lot of fun. I appreciate you all, and I adore the show. Thank you so much.
All right. Aww. Take care now. Be
thank
well.
Thank you.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye. Bye.
If you want to see what chock-a-block looks like, as Martha described it, there's a picture in Graham Blackburn's Illustrated Dictionary of Nautical Terms. You can find that at archive.org or openlibrary.org. That's Graham Blackburn's Illustrated Dictionary of Nautical Terms.
So much history inside a single word. We love talking about that. Call us about the word that's been rattling around in your brain or delighting you to say. 877-929-9673 or send it to us in email. The address is words@waywardradio.org. The town of Manacor on the island of Mallorca off the coast of Spain is famous for being the home of Rafael Nadal, the big tennis star. But there's another thing that's really remarkable about that town, and that is the town flag. You can look it up on the internet. It's yellow with four horizontal red stripes, and in the center there is an image of a human hand holding a red heart. And we're not talking like a Valentine's heart. We're talking about a human heart, a red human heart, which forms, as it turns out, a visual pun. It's like a rebus of the town's name, because the Catalan word ma means hand, like Spanish mano, and cor means a heart, like corazón in Spanish. So it's Manacor. It's a pun. On a flag.
Oh, that's a great flag. You know, I've never seen that. I follow the Vexillology subreddit.
Of course you do.
I've never seen. Yeah, it's a lovely group filled with amazing people who always post real flags and plus ones they've made up. And they're always really fantastic.
Yes,
but,
Vexillologists.
I've never seen that one. I'll have to post that one.
Take a look. It almost looks like a cartoon, but you won't forget it once you see it. But yes,
that's
Vexillology.
So that's Manacor. That's fantastic. Well, what's your interest? What's your sideline? And how does it plug into language? Because you know they all do. Let us know, words@waywardradio.org.
This show's about language seen through family, history, and culture. Stay tuned for more of Away with Words. Support for Away with Words comes from a gift honoring students of the San Diego Community College District.
City College, Mesa College, Miramar College, and continuing education prepare them for jobs, personal goals, and transfer to universities. sdccd.edu.
This program would be impossible without your support. Donate at waywardradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And ambling across the horizon with the sun in his eyes is our quiz guide, John Chinesky. Hi, John.
Hi, is that Grant? Is that Martha? I can't see with the sun in my eyes. I can't quite tell. You know, guys, I'm feeling a little peckish today, but I'm also trying to stay healthy. So I thought we'd do a little quiz about fruit. And language, of course, fruit and words. Many fruits are just fun to say as words. Papaya, elderberry, and of course, loquat. But let's see what happens when fruits slip over into parts of language that are not about food, okay? For example, one fruit is such a staple that one uses it to describe a person that is cherished, as in the blank of one's eye. You know what that is, right?
Sure, the apple of one's eye.
Apple. It's such a fruit staple. These next two are related in some way. This small fruit can be an adjective meaning new or in like new condition, like a car, say.
Cherry.
Cherry, baby. Yeah, it's a cherry car. Similarly, this stone fruit can be a noun meaning a particularly fine or delightful thing.
Peach.
Peach, as anyone in Georgia could tell you. Yeah, it's a peach. Now, though it makes some people squirm, I sometimes eat this particular fruit just like an orange. I love them. So I wonder why it's also a word for something bad or undesirable, like a car that breaks down too often.
Wait, you eat lemons like they're oranges?
I eat lemons like they're going out of style. Yeah.
You really do?
Sure do, yeah.
Wow.
They're just tasty. Now, this verb is unrelated etymologically to the oblong droop with a single hard stone or seed. But if you're doing this with someone who likes North African and Asian food crops, maybe bring a box of dried ones along on the movies, to the movies, yeah?
A date.
A date, yes. It's a date. It means lots of different things, but it's also a fruit. Now, when I was a kid, I thought it was the height of cleverness that this fruit gave its name to a jar filled with scraps of paper, each one containing an errand or job that typically the man of the house was asked to attend to.
Right, the honeydew.
The honeydew. It's a honeydew jar. Honey, do this. Honey, do that. Yeah. You know how they say intelligence is knowing a tomato is a fruit and wisdom is knowing not to put one in a fruit salad? Well, conversely, this leaf stalk isn't technically a fruit, but it's treated like one, so we can include it here. Its name is a slang term for a heated dispute or row.
A rhubarb.
A rhubarb, yes. It could also be the murmurs of the crowd while watching such a thing. I was, of course, a theater major, so we learned to say, yeah, rhubarb, 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 rhubarb. Now, you've done quite well on this fruit salad quiz. You've really used your noggin, or you could say a particular fruit that means head, or one that might fall on your head. In the tropics.
Oh. A coconut?
A coconut, yes. You've used your coconuts well today, my friends.
Oh, nice that old chestnut.
I'm going to save that one for the nut quiz. That's coming up.
Well, John, that was a grape quiz.
Oh, nice.
If you'd like to be put out of your misery and not hear any more of these fruit puns, give us a call, 877-929-9673. And John will be back with more quiz next week.
Take care.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, my name's Lola. I'm calling from Columbus, Wisconsin.
Hi, Lola. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Lola. What's up?
Well, I'm hoping you can help us name a room in our house. So we just purchased this house in Columbus, and it was built in 1921, and it doesn't really have a kitchen, or at least it didn't when we bought it. It has rooms that are kitchen-like and have things in it that are in kitchens, but they're not in the same rooms. So the room that we're calling a kitchen, when you walk into it from the back door, it has a stove, refrigerator, and then seven doorways that lead to other rooms. Behind one of those doors is a small room that has the original built-in cabinets and bins and a small counter and the kitchen sink. And that's the room that no one knows what to call because it doesn't really feel like a kitchen. It's not really part of the other room, but it's where we're putting all of our dishes and food. And it's a beautiful little space, and everyone walks into it and they go, I love this sink room. And we've tried washroom, but that sounds like you do laundry in it. And we've tried butler's pantry, but we definitely do not have a butler. So that also feels strange.
Wow. Why not call it the sink room?
That's got a long history of calling the rooms like that a sink room. Yeah.
Really? That seems so obvious.
Yeah, it is actually the old architectural term for it.
And what's so charming about this little room?
Well, it has these two little windows that look out over the backyard, and the built-in cabinets go from the floor to the ceiling, and they're just gorgeous. And it has a counter that's walnut, like this tree must have been gigantic. And the sink is enamel cast iron with the wash basins. It's just, I don't know, it's very romantic. Maybe cottagecore is the word now to use.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's too small for there to be a lot of people in there, so it feels really intimate and perfect for like winding down and doing dishes at the end of the day.
You really hit on a couple of real important notes there. One old dictionary describes a sink room as a room having a sink, especially a room near a kitchen in which utensils are kept and the coarser operations involved in cooking are performed. And that sounds pretty much like the room, but you're getting at a real core part of how houses used to be built. For centuries, houses in the United States were built with the idea that the stove, think of a Franklin stove, was a source of heat for other rooms in the house and not just the place where you made meals. So you didn't necessarily put all the food preparation surfaces around it. You might cook there, but the preparation, the cutting and the dicing would happen elsewhere, and the cleaning would happen elsewhere as well. And as a matter of fact, the stove was so often a part of heating that you might even have a little alcove off to the side of this place where the stove was. And this place was called the bed sink, where you might sleep on cold nights to be near the heat of the kitchen.
And there definitely used to be a different type of stove in the room we're calling the kitchen now.
I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if you would find a place where the ice box used to be, because a lot of times in these old houses, the ice box also wasn't near the stove. And so think about before refrigerators, you would want your ice box, you know, it had a big chunk of ice in it, far from the heat of the kitchen, usually on the north side of the house, so, you know, out of the sun, and at least in the northern hemisphere. And this way your ice is going to last for longer and your food has less chance of spoiling. So I wouldn't be surprised if your ice box was also maybe perhaps in that room with the sink or in one of these other seven doorways.
That's really interesting because there is another doorway that leads to the only room that has a floor that's concrete. And it looked like it had some point been maybe part of the sink room, but they'd put in a wall and put in a bathroom there. And there used to be there's old holes through there, like drains, that lead to the cistern below.
There we go.
So I
would not be surprised if that was originally the room for the ice box.
I want to call the downstairs bathroom the ice box now.
But yeah,
I have to see a man about an ice box. I love that.
And think also at a time when families were very large and hired help was commonplace, and you would want the dishwashing out of the way and the food preparation because both were pretty much never-ending tasks where you might have family gathered around the stove, and so all this other stuff had to happen out of the way of the stove, if that makes sense. You know, you might have the eating next to the stove as much as, you know, the few pots that were on it, but everything else needed to be moved because you could not have all these people in the way of these of the cleaning and the cutting and that so forth.
Well, Lola, you're making this place sound so romantic. Is this like a dream house for you?
Well, I think it's a dream. Some people walk in and think it's a nightmare. it needs a lot of work. When we first tried buying it, it was deemed uninhabitable, which couldn't possibly have been true because there were raccoons living in it at the time.
I was going to say that it's a joke.
So, but it's already, we've gotten some rooms that feel very done, and other rooms are still really good for a Halloween party that we plan on having. They're pretty creepy and in rough shape, but it's when we're done with it, it's going to be magical.
It sounds like it. Well, thank you so much for calling. This has been really fascinating.
Yeah, Lola, thank you so much. And think about Sync Room. That might be good.
Yeah, and a reality show.
I really like it. Yeah.
A reality show.
Well, thank you so much. Now we have a name for the bathroom and a name for the sink room.
All right. Take care now. Good luck with the house.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
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 Earlier, we were talking about chock-a-block with Jennifer. And, you know, if you have a situation where you do have two blocks up next to each other and they can't move, to fix that situation, you put slack in the tackle. That is, you add a little bit of slack to the rope. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly where we get our word overhaul, meaning to redo or remake completely.
Oh, no kidding. So it's like hauling over.
Well, haul, you know, is that classic nautical word. Haul is, you know, you're pulling on the lines, pulling on the sheets to make sails go up or to move things around. If you were overhauling a room in your house, you're behaving like a sailor, I guess.
And you need to cut yourself some slack because it's going to take longer and cost more than you ever imagined.
And maybe some rum.
There you go. Call us with your thoughts and observations about language, 877-929-9673.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Nick from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Welcome to the show. How can we help?
So my grandma used to say this phrase all the time, and my parents and I have no idea where it comes from. But when it got cold in wintertime and started turning into like fall, she'd say it's colder than Blitney outside. And I've Googled it over and over, and we have no idea what it means unless it's like a mix between the word blizzard and wintery, but I've never heard anyone else say it my entire life, and I've always just wondered, where does this come from?
Blitney, like B-L-I-T-N-E-Y, Blitney?
Yes, just like that.
Huh.
Okay, so where or what is Blitney, and why is it so cold?
Yes, exactly.
Nick, tell us a little bit about your grandmother.
She grew up in, like, Appalachia, Kentucky area. Mm-hmm. Grew up in the coal mines. And other than that, I don't really know much about her.
It's probably a variant of colder than Blixen, B-L-I-X-E-N, or cold as Blixen, which is analogous to saying cold as the Dickens or cold as hell. And we find this term in Illinois, in Indiana, West Virginia, Kentucky. Cold as Blixen probably comes from the German word for lightning, Blitz meaning lightning. But where Grant and I are going with this is that there are lots of variants about this. Colder than Blixen, colder than Blixes, colder than Blixian or Blixum, but there's also colder than Blixies. And I'm betting that's so close to colder than Blitney.
Well, the first time I said it was to my wife, actually, and she was just like, what does that even mean? I was like, I have no idea. It's just cold up.
Tell her it's at least 100 years old. Actually, yeah. You can find Cold as Blitzy in a 1921 novel. So at least 100 years old. And the other forms, the Blixen forms, well, they go back to at least the 1870s. So it's got a long history. It's not like you made it up last week.
There you go. So you're going to have a great winter, right?
Yes. I'll say it every other day, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Every time you talk to someone, it's cold and Blixies out there, isn't it? And they're here comes that Blixies guy again.
Or Blitney. I love your version. That's a new one on me, but
sure,
I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
Yeah, I think I might stick with Blitney. It just sounds, I don't know, it rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. It does.
Well, we may, you know, this show is heard all over the place, and we may hear other people who say, well, you know, he's not the only one who heard Blitney. So we might just find that this is a variant that just happens to be unrecorded.
That's
it's happened
right.
before.
That would be awesome.
Free Blitney. Well, Nick, thank you so much for calling.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, if you feel like you've got a scrap of language that you need to know more about, this little bit of parchment that's got some words on it, and you want to connect it to the larger body of language in the world, this is the place to go. 877-929-9673. Email us, words@waywardradio.org, or chat us up on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, Grant. Hi, Martha. This is Martha, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Martha.
Can't have too many Marthas.
No, you can't. So I was recently hanging out with some friends, and one of them made a crack about her imaginary boyfriend named Raul. And I thought that was pretty funny because I have an imaginary boyfriend named Raul. And then
what?
A third friend who was there was also like, wait, what? I have an imaginary boyfriend named Raul. And so we're all kind of like, how do we all have an imaginary boyfriend named Raul? And we figured that, oh, we're friends. Maybe one of us mentioned it a while ago or something and got it in our minds. But then the next day, I was talking to another friend totally outside that social circle, told her about this, and she said, no way. I know somebody with an imaginary boyfriend named Raul.
So this is four people with a Raul.
Yes. And we're all pretty much the same age. And I'm thinking, well, this is more than just a coincidence. There has got to have been a Raul in popular culture that, I don't know, that we knew about but forgot about. And I'm just wondering what the explanation could be.
Well, first of all, let me just tell you right away, this will maybe add to the fire of your amazement, is that there was a short-lived TV show called Committed on the air in 2005, just it lasted one season. It starred Jennifer Finnegan, and her character has an imaginary boyfriend named Raul.
What? No.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Okay, I've never heard of that show, though.
Yeah, it lasted one season. I mean, she's a great actor, but it just didn't catch, you know, so it didn't get renewed. So that's five Raouls out there in the world.
My goodness. Anybody in that bunch a fan of Phantom of the Opera? I'm thinking about the lead guy in that.
No.
Raul, who's sort of dashing and...
Oh, yeah. So Martha in Portland, let me ask you, is there something about Raul that suggests, say, you know, your summer abroad or your gap year or someone that you might meet on your travels, you know, is there something about Raul that suggests not the guy next door?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that's probably where I thought I came up with a name was just, you know, somebody who is completely outside of my sphere and seems like he must be suave and exciting.
Yeah.
Well, Martha, this is a real mystery. We might have to put this out to
we are going to put our listener.
We what? Are. We're going to crowdsource this.
What
thing.
Is your imaginary lover's name? Is there are there more Raouls out there?
Yeah. If you're are out there, Raulias? Raul, give us a call. Show yourself.
Yeah. Who do you, when you joke about having an imaginary boyfriend or girlfriend, what name do you give them? Let us know. And Martha, we're going to find out exactly who this Raul is.
I don't know, but you guys had an answer.
We're working on it, Martha. So,
you can hear
so
us vamping. We'll find out. Martha in Portland, thank you so much for your call. Take care now, all right?
Oh, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
We appreciate it. Bye-bye. All right. Who is your imaginary boyfriend or girlfriend, and what name do they have? Are there more Raouls out there? Let us know. 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org or talk about it on Twitter at WAYWORD. Support for Away with Words comes from Jack and Caroline Raymond, proud sponsors of Wayward Inc., the nonprofit that produces and distributes this program. You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Look up into the night sky and imagine that you've never heard the term Milky Way. What would you call that glowing band of stars across the heavens? In English, we think of those stars as a milky path across the sky, and we have the Greeks and the Romans to thank for that idea. But it's not the same in other languages and other cultures. For example, in Sweden, it's called Vintergatan, which means simply winter street, and that alludes to the fact that the galaxy is far easier to see there during the winter months, unlike summer, when the sun's glow continues long into the evening and can make it harder to see. And in Hawaii, the Milky Way is sometimes called Ialele Iaka, and that name translates as fish jumping in shadows. Isn't that gorgeous?
Oh, that's lovely.
And in the Cherokee language, there's a name that translates as where the dog ran. And the idea here is that there was a dog that was once caught eating cornmeal from someone's bowl. And as the dog is chased away, that last mouthful of cornmeal scatters across the sky. I love the idea of looking up into the sky and imagining that that's cornmeal scattered all the way where the dog's.
the scamp getting away with his little crime, running off. And the people chasing him, probably laughing because they, you know, they recognize a kindred spirit when they see one.
So now when I look up at the night sky, it's a great reminder that we all divide up the world differently. You know, we give different kinds of names to things.
Well, there's a lot to be said for knowing how the other people who speak other languages look at the world. We try to help you do that, and you can help us do that by sharing your multilingual experience with us and the world. Give us a call, 877-929-9673, email words@waywardradio.org, or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Deborah from Lawrenceburg, Indiana.
Hey, Deborah, welcome to the show.
What's up? How can we help?
My grandfather had a lot of funny expressions, mostly one-liners. But my favorite one, and one that I'm finding very applicable today, is when he would call someone Desperate Ambrose, and then followed by, he's so desperate he'd steal a hot stove.
That's pretty desperate.
The imagery of that was always tickles me. You know, you think of somebody trying to get out of a house with a hot stove and it's pretty desperate.
Yeah, that'd be tricky.
So that's Ambrose, A-M-B-R-O-S-E, the name Ambrose.
Right. So I didn't know, you know, where that might have come from. My grandpa was a young man during the Depression, and I wondered if that was maybe a Depression term.
Oh, yeah, that's a good connection. He's got two different terms here that he's kind of brought together. Desperate Ambrose is one thing, and then the saying about stealing a hot stove is another. So let's take these separately. There was a comic strip drawn by an artist by the name of Charles Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, ran from about 1910 to 1940, had a couple different names, but the main one was Samatter Pop, basically an abbreviation of What's the Matter, Pop. And it included a character called Desperate Ambrose. And this was this odd little boy who was the neighbor to these other children. The only way I can describe him for modern audiences, he was kind of like a Charlie Brown character, kind of morose in a way and introspective and thoughtful, but at the same time, a little like Lucy from Peanuts as well, in terms of always just kind of doing things to other people, you know, to kind of get what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And Charles Schulz, the creator of the Peanuts comic strip, has actually said that this character of Desperate Ambrose was an influence on his strip. So that's where Desperate Ambrose comes from. And as a matter of fact, by the time World War I rolled around, the character was popular enough that you can find mentions of people being compared to Desperate Ambrose in, you know, military newsletters and newspapers columns and different places. So it quickly became like people were known as a Desperate Ambrose, or it was a nickname in college and high school yearbooks.
That is so interesting. Charles Payne, did you say?
Yeah, Charles Payne. There's a real nice entry of about him in, you can find this online, it's the Lambiek, L-A-M-B-I-E-K, Comicalopedia online. You can just find more information about him. It's L-A-M-B-I-E-K, Comicalopedia, Lambiek Comicalopedia. And then the other one is, being somebody who would steal a hot stove. Well, this old expression goes back to the 1860s, and it's about somebody just being such a thieving rascal that even if a stove were red hot, think about the old stove, not the modern ones. Think about the ones that are all metal. And so they're so full of heat and fire that the thing is glowing red that they'd steal it. That's how much of a low-down, dirty dog that they were. That's what we're talking about here. There was actually a Chicago politician in the early 20th century who was called Hot Stove Jimmy Quinn because he was so crooked.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's great. I love it.
And there's an even longer version of that phrase that goes, so desperate he would steal a hot stove and come back for the smoke.
Yeah, that was usually credited
to
credited to the playwright Wilson Misner, who had a lot of funny one-liners.
And come back for the smoke.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to add that. I'm going to add that now when I say it. That's perfect.
Yeah, that's a good one, right?
That's just about the thievingest person you ever wanted to meet, right?
Oh, that's funny. Isn't that fun?
Yeah, it is fun. It's lovely to remember those old sayings from the grandparents and just fondly remember their cleverness and the way they can take something and turn a phrase and make you giggle. I just love it.
I still think about him and giggle when I think of that one. You know, when my husband said it the other day.
Treasure
thought,
that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Something to hang on
it's
to.
A treasure.
Those linguistic
thank
heirlooms,
you.
Deborah.
Deborah, thanks for calling.
Love your show. Thank you so much.
Be well.
Take care.
Thanks
bye-bye.
For calling,
bye-bye.
Deborah. Bye-bye. The Spanish word for padlock is candado, and it comes from the Latin word catenatus, which means chained, and it's a relative of the English word concatenation, which is one of my favorite words. It means a chain of events or a chain of things, a concatenation. So the Spanish word for padlock is candado, but in Colombia and the Dominican Republic, it has another meaning. The word candado means a goatee. It's like, you know, it's like the mustache over your lip and under your, you know, the hair.
Oh, so they're chained together?
Well, it looks like a padlock.
Oh, it does. It totally does. That's right. Oh, it's like the loop of the lock and then the square bulk part below with the mechanism. Oh. My favorite term for that I heard in English, though, is a pudding ring.
Pudding ring.
It looks like you've been eating pudding out of a pudding container, a round pudding container, and you like put it up to your
adorable.
Mouth so you could get the all of it out. So it's like you left a chocolate ring of pudding around your mouth.
Oh, that's pretty funny. Yeah, in Spanish, it's often called a circular or española, you know, circular or in the Spanish style. But I do like the padlock pudding ring.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, we've got a lot of multilingual listeners to the show, and we love to hear how you phrase things in your languages. Let us know. words@waywardradio.org.
Hi there. You have a way with words.
Hi, this is Kyle calling from Fort Monroe, Virginia.
Hi, Kyle. What's up?
So I'm calling about the word hanyak, which is a term commonly used in our family, but whose actual origin or meaning has been a bit of a mystery to us and is I'd love to know more about. The word is typically used, at least how it's been used by our family, is kind of to refer to somebody who might be an idiot or a dummy, somebody who kind of acts in a silly way, and not really in a way that's like pejorative or mean, but kind of in a fun kind of way. And I would say this was commonly used, at least by my grandpa, to refer to politicians or bad drivers, things like that.
Okay. Yeah, that's making a lot of sense. And so the whole family says it now. His children and his grandchildren also say hunyak.
Yeah, I would say I remember it mostly from him, but we've all kind of used it as kind of a tongue-in-cheek way in daily life to kind of avoid using maybe an obscenity where one might be warranted. But yeah, we continue to use it. I use it, my mom uses it, and we have no idea where it comes from. So we'd love to make sure that we're using it correctly, that there isn't maybe some other interesting history.
It does have a history, and we can tell you a lot about it. There are a couple of spellings and a couple of different ways to say it. So H-U-N-Y-A-K, H-O-N-Y-O-C-K, and a few more. And some people say hunyaker or hunyaker. And what it is a word that originally referred to people from Hungary. Unlike other waves of European immigrants that spoke Romance languages, their Hungarian sounded different to American ears, so they kind of got their own term. You know, people call them their own word. And this word is maybe modeled on Hun, H-U-N, a term for Germans, particularly common during World War I, plus the Ack, the A-A-C-K, from Polak, meaning a Polish person. This is the late 1800s, early 1900s. This term starts to appear when this population of young men starts to appear. And these young men working in the steel mills, working in the factories, and most of them took their hard-earned paychecks and sent them home so that they could bring their families to the new world. But some of them took those paychecks, and every Friday and Saturday, they blew them in the bars, and they blew them on drinking, and sometimes they'd get into fights. And so when other people called them Hunyaks, they were thinking about the troublemakers and not the good guys who were doing the right thing. And so that's why there's that negativity around that term Hunyak or Hunyaker. And it kind of had this connotation of somebody who was foolish or did unwise things or was unsophisticated, and it became broadly used to mean any Eastern European immigrant, especially people from Poland too, and later to any immigrant at all. And over time, and this is where it's going to connect to your family, there was something called semantic bleaching. And semantic bleaching is when the negativity kind of fades out of a term, and all that's left is, in this case, something where it just means anyone who's kind of a little bit silly or foolish or maybe just a little unsophisticated. And that's where we are with your use of it, referring to bad drivers or foolish politicians, a Hunyak.
Wow.
Kyle, there are a couple more levels to this. There are other forms of it, for example, bohunk and hungy and hunk, H-U-N-K, not related at all to meaning, you know, a well-built man. But and also the word honky, H-O-N-K-E-Y, and this is indeed the origin of the same derogatory term for any white person that we know today. Honky comes from this word honyak.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, and, my goodness. That's
and if you're
crazy.
Ever doing any research on the history of Midwestern cities in the U.S., you might find unusual references to Hunky Town or Hunky Row. And although that seems really funny, it probably was an unofficial name for the part of a neighborhood or a street settled by foreigners or immigrants who worked in the mills and factories.
Wow, that's incredible. I had no idea there was such a history.
It's a lot of history, right?
That is something. Wow, that's really cool.
It's got its roots in this wave of Eastern European immigration. It's so much of what we say has a story, and your family is carrying the story forward every time they use the word Hunyak.
That's incredible. My grandfather unfortunately passed away early last year, and we were afraid that because we never heard anyone else use it, that the history was going to go now that he wasn't around to explain it. But this is amazing. Definitely not what I expected.
Yeah, and definitely not just your family. It's pretty widespread. We hear this question fairly often.
That's really cool. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling, Kyle, and sharing some history from your family.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, take care. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Be well.
Bye.
877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org and Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hi there. You have a way with words.
Hello. This is Juice, and I am calling from Genoa, New York. When I was growing up, my mom, who was a daughter of Czechoslovakian immigrants, had several phrases that have always stuck in my mind, and I never asked her when she was alive where they came from or why she said them. So I thought maybe you could help.
We'll give it a try.
Yeah, what were they?
The first one that comes to mind is, I am so mad I could spit nickels. And as a child, I was pretty scared of her, but I always thought, boy, I wish you would.
Why not dollar bills?
Well, when I was a kid 60 years ago, you know, nickels were pretty cool. A lot of the dependent candy store for nickels.
So mad I could spit nickels.
Like she was a slot machine paying off.
That's what I was wondering as I was thinking about this. It's like, what would spit nickels? A slot machine? But that doesn't seem like you'd be mad.
No, it's just one of a variety of these things that you spit. You're so angry that, well, there's just the expression, I'm so angry I could spit, or spit. I could spit. Yeah, people would say, I could spit, just meaning they're angry, or I could spit tacks, I could spit nails, I could spit rust, I could chew nails, I could spit rivets, I could spit blood, or I could spit 10 feet. There are a lot of these.
Who spits when they're angry? Well, camels. Maybe camels spit.
Camels do, yeah. Well, I don't know if they're angry, but they definitely spit. And in Australia, if they're they spit chips if they're thirsty.
A what?
And yeah, really? They spit chips if they're thirsty. I'm so thirsty I could spit chips. And some people, if they're thirsty, they spit cotton. But anyway, okay. Yeah, the origin of this is murky, but it's really just about you being so angry that you do something extraordinary, that you're out of your head. You're behaving unusually. You know, when we are angry, we don't act ourselves.
That is true. That is true. My mom chose to spit nickels. So, and the other one, she used to say, if we were in the car and a motorcycle would speed past us, she'd say, he's going to go head over tin cups. So I have no idea why he would go head over tin cups.
Martha, that's one of a set, isn't it? There's head over heels, of course, but rump over tea kettle or head over teacups and ass over elbow or head over appetite or head over apple cart and all different variety of things. And these go back well into the 1800s. And they're all polite ways of saying that you fell down and you're discombobulated and you fell so far that your rear end went over your front end.
Ah, okay. Kind of cartoon style. Yeah.
Cartoon style. All maybe even a little bit like what they're today on the internet, they call it the full scorpion. The full scorpion is where you fall down face first and your back legs go up over your head, kind of like a scorpion's tail reaching for a sting.
Yeah, that's a hard landing. Wow.
Yeah.
So they're both pretty straightforward.
They are. And yeah, now that you're saying them, it's like, oh, right.
Well, yeah, it sounds like your mom had a lot of expressions, Juice.
She did. And her name was Mary Martha. So I always remember, I'm taken by that name. So, yeah.
Well, I've said it before. I'll say it again. You can't have too many Marthas.
No, you can't. Aww.
Thanks for calling. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, I really Juice. Love your show. And thank you again for taking my call.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks to senior producer Stephanie Levine, editor Tim Felton, and production assistant Rachel Elizabeth Weisler.
You can send us messages, subscribe to the podcast and newsletter, and catch up on hundreds of past episodes at waywardradio.org.
Our toll-free line is always open in the U.S. and Canada, 877-929-9673, or email us words@waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
Many thanks to Wayward board member and our friend Bruce Rogo for his help and expertise.
Thanks for listening. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
WRCT is on AOL Instant Messenger. Our screen name is WRCT883. Send us a shout-out so we can make fun of your atrocious spelling. Send us a request. Send us anything. We're bored. WRCT, 88.3 FM on your radio, WRCT.org on the internet, and now WRCT883 on AOL Instant Messenger. In the language of the kids today, we're the bomb. That's right, isn't it? That's what the kids say. We're the bomb, correct? Okay.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Check my math and follow along. 88.3 over 100 is not 0.883. We exponentiate. Euler's number raised to not 0.883 is 2.418. Multiply by 1,000 to result 2,418. Add 401. Result 2,819. Multiply 25. 5 by 9 is 45. 5 by 1 is 5, and 4 is 9. 5 by 8 is 40. 5 by 2 is 10, and 4 is 14. 20 by 9 is 180. 20 by 1 is 20, and 10 is 30. 20 by 8 is 160. 20 by 2 is 40, and 10 is 50. Sum 70,475. Add 404. 70879. Multiply 11. Result 779669. Add 20. 779,689. Divide 10. Result 7796.89. Square root 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
That's what's bothering me. I want to be a man cub, and stroll right into town and be just like the other men. I'm tired of mugging around. Oh, ooby-doo, I want to be like you. I want to walk like you, talk like you. You see it's true. An ape like me can learn to be you.
Try to kid me, man cub. I made a deal with you. What I desire is man's red fire to make my dream come true. Now give me the secret, man cub. Come on, clue me what to do. Give me the power of man's red flower so I can be like you.
done wrong. Half the people are done wrong. And the baby, they do sabba do the day, do bum do book the days of bones, a bum bum bum.
Abba do dee.
Will a reap another?
Ever do a doy.
Will a laugh a zinny?
Wall a but, will a but,
steeple a thorny. Will a ha 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 ha. Get mad, baby.
I want to be like you.
I want to walk like you. Talk like you. Do woo woo. You see, it's you. Someone like me. Can learn to be like someone like me. Take me home, daddy. Can learn to be like someone like you.
One more time.
Yeah, can learn to be like someone like me. Say, did the bop bop.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
I do like to listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, but it does strange things to my head.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy, so we show them how. And we tell them with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
So talk, they hear you. You can do it if you try.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the impacts of climate disruption are not theoretical, they are happening. Those already worst off are facing the worst of it, and those who profit from it continue to profit. There are finer points, but that's reality. And it's fair to measure journalism not by its cleverness or demonstrated balance between the voices of power players, because when it comes to climate change, power players are the problem, but by the justice they do to that reality. As national leaders meet at COP26 in Glasgow to discuss ways to confront the already unfolding disaster, the Washington Post is suggesting U.S. readers celebrate, what's this? The Transportation Department's Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration's decision to finalize a rule extending federal pipeline safety standards to more than 400,000 miles of currently unregulated onshore gathering lines. You can acknowledge that certain steps are good without thereby suggesting that they are within shouting distance of enough. When it comes to climate change, we'll talk about comparing what's happening to what needs to happen with environmental scientist and advocate and longtime climate conference participant and observer, Michael K. Dorsey. Also on the show, in the wake of horrifying front page photos from September, the Biden administration says that the U.S. Border Patrol will no longer use horses to round up Haitian asylum seekers. They are flushing out of makeshift shelters to send back over the border into Mexico without the opportunity to present their case about the dangers they've spent, in many cases, years trying to escape. That may cut down.